Hello, everyone. My name is Kelly Munn, and I'm with the League of Education Voters. Most of you know us as LEV. Welcome to our online webinar series called Lunchtime Levinars. This is the conclusion of our legislative Levinar series. Today, our own Government Relations Director, Frank Ordway, will talk about LEV's legislative priorities, what passed, what didn't pass, and why. Please ask questions throughout the presentation. We will leave at least 10 minutes for questions and may give even more time to questions based on the number of questions that are being sent to us. You can write your questions in the chat function of the left-hand side of the webinar. Please remember to be respectful, as this conversation is public and will be archived for later access on our website. Before we give the floor to Frank Ordway, here are a few quick reminders. LEV will be live tweeting the webinar using the hashtags, hashtag WAEDU, hashtag LEVinar, and hashtag WALEG. Follow these hashtags or at EdVoters or at Frank Ordway on Twitter to join the conversation. Today's presenter is LEV's Government Relations Director, Frank Ordway. Over the past 23 years, he has been a managing staff or board member with domestic and international organizations focusing on sustainable economic development, strategic technology use, social services, energy, transportation, domestic violence, and the environment, not to mention being here at LEV on education. The common themes throughout all this work has been empowering people to make positive changes in their communities. Frank received his master's degree in public affairs from the Evans School at the University of Washington and his bachelor's in political science from the University of Oregon. He attended public schools in Oregon and Wyoming, and his kids attend Mountain View Elementary in Ferndale, Washington. Frank volunteers for various community groups and is the parent chair of the Ferndale Public School Levy Committee. Frank lives in Ferndale with his wife, Rachel, and three children, Dylan, Olivia, and Nora. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Frank Ordway. Frank, you can take it from here.
Thank you, Kelly, very much, and thank you all for taking some time today to join us on the webinar. As Kelly mentioned, this is our legislative wrap-up session, and the legislative session closed last week with 7 minutes to spare, so our representatives and senators can say that they finished early. But it was a momentous session, even though it was a short session, and even though there was not major work done on the state's budget, which is typical of a short session, we did manage to be part of some major policy wins for kids, as well as setting the stage, I think, for future advancement of our cause for high-quality education for all kids in Washington State. We had a number of bills that we were working on heading into the session, as I think most folks on the call probably know. We work early learning K-12 and higher education, and we worked on bills in each one of those arenas this session and had some successes. We have a public legislative bill tracker that is available on our website if you'd like to take a look at a variety of bills that we were working on, and you can see it on the screen now. So I'm just going to run through a couple of these. We won't go into the details, and please, if you have questions about specific bills as we go on, please fire them in. There was a number of bills, and it's a very good trend in the legislature where you're seeing a much more concerted and thoughtful effort to pursue policies that are specific to closing our state's achievement gap. So you are seeing efforts in early learning and in K-12 and in social services with a very crystalline and crisp view of trying to address the issues that exacerbate or create the opportunity and achievement gap in Washington State. So you saw a number of bills this session related to that that passed and ultimately passed with significant bipartisan support. Some of them, like Bill 2519, just simply closed a loophole where children that were moving in and out of the child welfare system would often find their eligibility for high-quality early learning rescinded, and they had to reapply, even though the nature of their economic status had not changed. And so 2519 ensures that kids that are moving in and out of the welfare system continue to receive the services for which they are eligible. Which is a small issue given the number of kids, but very, very profoundly important for the kids that were affected by that loophole. We saw a number of bills like 6062, 6074, and 6129 that all addressed different elements of the opportunity and achievement gap in Washington State, addressing issues of homeless students, ensuring that districts' collective bargaining agreements reflect some elements of how we are closing the opportunity and achievement gap. Paraeducators, who are often the folks in our schools who end up with a lot of the kids that are in special ed or that need special assistance, are often helped by our paraeducators. And there were no real standards for the training and support of our paras, which are a critical part of our education system. And Bill 6129, for the first time, set minimum employment standards, professional development goals, setting up a career ladder for paraeducators to ultimately become teachers. And so these folks are some of the most critical cogs in our education system, and for the first time they will have some standards and guidance about how to do their jobs best and some sense of actual professional support for the hard work that they do. In addition to those bills, we also there was a signature bill that got a lot of attention both in the state and nationally. It ended up being 6523, the Dream Act, or in some cases the Real Hope Act, depending on who you're talking to. But that was a multi-year effort to ensure that all students who graduate from high school in Washington State, regardless of immigration status, can get access to financial aid to go to school. Also, we had a bill 6424, which is a nice bill that establishes what we call the state seal of biliteracy to recognize public school students who already who have attained proficiency in multiple languages, and in particular for our recent immigrants, when they learn English, the opportunity to honor the language that their native language that they came with as a real asset to our state, as well as students who develop proficiency in multiple languages. This seal, while a small gesture, will be very meaningful for the kids and the families who receive it. One of the biggest efforts, a multi-year effort among the League of Education Voters, our partners, in particular Partnership for Learning and Stand for Children, as well as a host of others, was 6552. For the first time in many years, we have moved the expectations that we have of our high schools and the kind of diplomas that they provide to our students. We've moved to have a set of standards that actually match to our modern economy. Until this bill passed, Washington State had some of the lowest graduation requirements of any state in the nation. We had some of the lowest requirements when it came to science and math of any state in the nation. And for a state that is utterly dependent on innovation and trade, those low expectations and low requirements were doing active harm to our students' ability to engage fruitfully in our economy and democracy. And so this multi-year effort, which began back in 2007, came to fruition with the passage of 6552. And now once the governor signs it, which we expect in the coming days, our state will have graduation requirements that are on par with our other states that we compete with, on par with our international competitors, and will provide our students multiple pathways to graduation. But each one of those pathways will be distinctly preparing those students for post-secondary opportunities, whether that's a technical school, a two-year school, or a four-year school. What we hope this bill accomplishes is we have a dramatic downturn in the number of students who need remediation when they go to college. Currently, only 4 in 10 of our graduates from high school are able to attend college and start taking credit-bearing courses right away. The other 6 out of 10 need to take some remedial courses, and that is an incredibly high number. It puts, in particular, low- and moderate-income students and their families behind the eight ball in terms of their ability to even afford to go to school if they have to borrow money for remediation. And so it is our hope that with the passage of this bill and the establishment of these requirements and the supports that will come along with it, that we will see a dramatic increase in the number of high school graduates in Washington State leaving high school with real options and real choices going forward for their careers and their options for college. So this was a major effort. It ultimately passed both chambers of the legislature with overwhelming bipartisan support. While we were gratified by that support, it did not indicate the amount of effort that it took to actually get this done by many people here on the phone, as well as our partners and supporters around the state. So this was a major achievement and win in this short session. Some things that did not get done in this session that are important to note: there was a major push to increase the quality of our child care system that did not ultimately pass, but we think it was called the Early Start Act, although we do feel it is well positioned for action in 2015, and we have significant bipartisan support for that effort. There was also no major efforts made on how we address school funding going forward. I suspect that most people on the phone are familiar with the fact that we are currently, the Supreme Court has found that our state is out of compliance with its own constitution in terms of how much we fund our schools, how we structure that funding, as well as the outcomes that we get for that funding. And there was the Supreme Court asked the legislature to produce a plan to address the McCleary decision by April 30th, and I do not expect that the plans that the legislature ultimately sends to the court to have a lot of meaning, and so that was an area where there was simply not a great deal of progress made, and I don't expect to see progress made until after the elections coming this fall. So while there were some significant wins, and we're very proud of that work, there is also a lot of work to be done going forward, and we look forward to taking part in supporting our champions in the elections this fall, and working with all of you on the phone and our partners across the state to try to craft a real, sustainable, equitable funding solution for our schools going forward. And so with that, I'd like to throw it open to questions about either legislation, the current landscape of politics related to education in Washington State. One other thing that did not pass the session that I neglected to mention was a bill that would ensure that we maintained our waiver from No Child Left Behind. The legislative action that was required to ensure that we are not under the provisions of that act did not pass, and we are now waiting to see what the reaction of the federal government is to that and whether or not they actually pull our waiver from No Child Left Behind. We fought very hard to try to maintain the waiver. We were not successful, and if the feds do indeed pull our waiver, we will be looking in 2015 to try to rectify the situation to ensure that the Title I dollars that are aimed at our most at-risk children are maintained under the control of our school districts. So with that, I would like to throw it open to questions, concerns, or thoughts from any of you about either individual pieces of legislation, the session itself, or thoughts about where we might be going in 2015. So let's throw it open to questions.
Thank you, Frank. Listeners, you can type your questions in the chat section on the left side of the webinar. We really encourage your questions. This is really the opportunity to engage with Frank and ask the questions that that everyone probably wants to ask, but nobody's asking the question. While I'm waiting for a question right now, Frank, I'm going to ask you a question or two. And one is the DREAM Act, Think DREAM Act, when it went through the Real Start bill, it had a $5 million addition for the needs grants.
Yep.
Where did that go? Did it happen or not?
It did. And so right now, the DREAM Act passed, and it did in the version that ultimately passed the Senate and was signed into law by the governor, it did include an additional $5 million for our state need grant program. I do think it's important to remind folks that currently our state need grant program is dramatically underfunded. We have close to 30,000 students in our state who are state residents, high school graduates who qualify for state grant, need grant support, but do not receive it. And so one of the concerns about the DREAM Act was that if we open up the doors to additional students, aren't we really just giving them the right to be told no? because we don't have enough money to cover all the students that are currently eligible. And so the thinking behind the $5 million, the additional $5 million that was put in, was that we were not going to increase the number of students who are being who aren't getting that support. And so in 2015, I'm relatively certain that for the League of Education Voters, full funding of the state need grant program will be one of our priorities.
Thank you, Frank. We have a couple of questions coming in. One is around the waiver. And can you explain more fully what you mean by losing the money or losing money?
So what happens, this is a very complicated situation, but what happens is that the state is allocated Title I dollars by the federal government for specific use and support of low-income students. And those dollars are typically, while focused on that particular group of students, is fairly flexible in terms of how local school districts can use that money. But what happens under the provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act, and because of the way the act was designed, this ultimately would happen to every district, is that once you are deemed failing, that you are no longer making progress for your students, if you are considered, you know, what the Fed's reaction to that is to, quote-unquote, take control of a part of your Title I money. If they view that your school or your school district is not successfully educating students, they are going to take some of that money and say you have to use it in a new way. And unfortunately, that new way has very little accountability attached to it. So what happens is, let's just take Seattle Schools for an example. Let's say, to keep it easy, that they receive $100 of Title I money. The feds are going to say to Seattle, you can only budget for next year 80 of those dollars, and you have to set 20 of them aside. And if community organizations that want to provide tutoring or other services for those kids register with the school district, you have to hire them using that 20% set aside to provide those services. Now, on the face of it, that might not seem outrageous. You've got a school that is deemed failing. It's not serving those kids well. We're going to spend the money in a more effective way. However, the measurement of whether or not you are a failing school underneath the provisions of No Child Left Behind are inexact at best, meaning that ultimately every school would be deemed failing, which is, you know, not true. Second, there's no accountability on where those dollars go. And one of my very first experiences at Lev was visiting a group of very rural school districts in Washington State who were doing remarkable things for those students, sending them to college at remarkable rates. And I went out to find out just, you know, how they were doing it and what was happening. And when I asked them what we could do to help, they said, because they were under the provisions of No Child Left Behind at that time, they were losing teachers. They had to lay off teachers when they lost control of that money, and they saw their class sizes go from 20 kids to 30 because they had to, again, lay off teaching talent because there was a gentleman who was a provider that the federal law required them to hire who was providing essentially no service, but he was doing it with multiple rural school districts, vacuuming up that Title I money himself, not providing good services to kids. And so the result of losing the waiver can really have profound impacts on schools large and small and whether or not our low-income and most at-risk kids get the services they need. And we felt and still feel that losing the waiver was too much of a risk for those students. And we hope that we can figure out a way in 2015 to make sure that we maintain it.
And a follow-up question to that, Frank, is this is from Ramona, and that is the possibility here of some districts receiving the waiver. Apparently this happened in California?
Yes, and so right now California does not have a state-level waiver from No Child Left Behind. They are still under the provisions of the original act. However, individual school districts in California who have adopted the policies necessary to get the waiver have applied for individual waivers and received them. But what that has established now is a fundamentally different education, accountability, and equity system on a district-by-district basis in the state of California. And I have a hard time seeing how that is good for students. While it might provide an individual district some relief, In particular, our low-income students, when you look at the data, they move around. They move around a lot. In particular, in the South King County area, we see most of those students attending multiple districts over the course of their school time. And if they're moving from one accountability system to another, one set of rules for kids to another, that does not help educate those kids better. And so while we might see some individual districts here apply for the waiver, we'll see. But in other states, it has happened, but I would not call that a positive outcome in the big picture for those states.
I'm going to switch topics. One person has commented about, in terms of the meaningful high school diploma, what type of supports, and it's really more of a comment, but I'm going to form it as a question, that there is an importance with having supports in place for students to graduate on time, and that includes credit retrieval, things like summer school. And what did the Meaningful High School Diploma Bill do to meet that, if it did?
Excellent question, and it's a concern that we share. There's a couple of things that are in the bill that help address it, and then there's some things that are not directly tied to the bill, both in the last budget, as well as where we expect things to go in the future that will help with those issues. Within the bill itself, you do have, of the 24 credits, I think it's important to recognize that they are not prescriptive. It is not a list of 24 that you have to take. There is seven electives within those 24. And when it comes to the math and the science portion of the requirements, there was a cross-crediting course equivalency piece of the bill that will allow CTE and occupational ed programs to fit within the framework. So students will have a great deal of flexibility in what they choose. I think that's important because if you're being prescriptive, I think the chances of losing more students goes up. Second, there is a two-credit flexibility portion of the Act. The original concept from the state board was that if you failed a course and had to retake it, that you could use up to two credits in that process. They called it recovery credits. What the legislature ultimately passed was a little bit more nuanced in that if you are a student with special circumstances, perhaps you moved here from another country or another state, perhaps you had a profound familial challenge during your high school career related to illness or homelessness or other sorts of circumstances, that the districts will have some leeway in using those two credits on an individual basis for students. So we wanted to make sure that students that otherwise who had done all the work, tried very hard, and were successful in the rest of their courses, if they had some extenuating circumstances that just kept them from finishing those last two credits, that the districts would have some leeway. And I think that's an important element to this. Also, the course, the legislation included the requirement of a very robust high school and beyond plan process involving parents or guardians and school counselors. And that is not something that our state has done a lot of in the past. The robustness and the effectiveness of that part of this, I think, is really going to be key to the success of this legislation. If you've got good support from counselors and buy-in from your parents about what you're doing in high school, the evidence is very clear that the results are much better for those students. We can look at the state's own experience with the College Bound program, where students in middle school have signed up for the College Bound program. It puts them on a track to go to college. They've received regular counseling and supports in those school districts related to the College Bound program to ensure that they understand the resources that they will be given when they graduate. And now you see evidence that the kids that enroll in that program are performing as well, if not better, than every other set of students in the schools. So we need to ensure that same level of support is there for students across the state. So some other things that we saw in the last budget that we expect to see more of going forward was an increased investment in LAP and other programs aimed specifically at low-income students. We saw a prioritization of counselors in terms of how the prototypical school model was rolled out. And we will continue to fight to ensure that the counseling portion of prototypical schools is emphasized in terms of funding in 2015. We also saw an increased appreciation and necessity around ELL endorsements for teachers. And so we'll continue to push on all of those things to ensure that students have the supports they need to be successful with this new level of graduation requirements. I think it's also important to note that the evidence in our own state and around the country is pretty clear that when you increase rigor, you do not increase dropout rates. You actually, the opposite is true, and that most students who are dedicated to graduating will graduate with higher standards, and that the evidence actually shows across all sectors and across all demographics that there are slight increases in graduation rates when standards go up, not the other way around. So we hope that that trend holds true in Washington State as these requirements are instituted or implemented. And I think it's important to note that they are not required until 2019. So it's the current class of seventh graders who will really benefit from this act. And so we'll and we expect that there'll be some districts that are early adopters and some that are late, but there is adequate time, we believe, for the school districts to build those supports in preparation for the class of 2019.
And one additional question around the 6163 bill. This is the Closing the Gaps bill. Was money appropriated to implement the pilot?
No, money was not. So what we hope is, because the process was set up in that bill for schools to apply one portion of the act. The act had a couple of pieces. One was establishing a council specific to extended learning opportunities before and after school. And as somebody who used to be an executive director of a science museum who tried to work very closely with our local schools, there are significant barriers to community organizations working effectively and formally with schools across our state. So there's a council that was created to address those barriers. That's an important piece of the act. Another piece of the act was setting up a grant program for summer school. What the act did was establish the framework and the policies that will be used in that grant application process, and then we will come back in 2015 and fight for the dollars to pay for the program. So our hope would be that the first set of summer school extended learning opportunities would happen in the summer of 2015.
Thank you, Frank. I'm going to switch gears, and we're going to talk a little bit about funding. There were a couple of questions. One is, what's the status of funding for full-day K and smaller class size?
We made significant progress on full-day K in the 2013-2014 biennial budget. We went from, if I remember correctly, and maybe if some of the other policy staff who might be on the call can make sure my numbers are accurate, or at least close to it, but we were funding well below 50% of our full-day K across the state, and now we are over 50%, and it enjoys widespread support in the legislature in terms of support for all-day K funding. We've made very modest, and that's almost an insult to modesty, progress on the class size part of the ledger. There was additional money put into K-1 class size reduction, in particular in high-poverty schools, but there was not a significant amount put into one of the largest buckets of the McCleary ruling in terms of where we are currently short in funding. So we're making good progress in all-day K. Class size is a different story. And the class size money is challenging because we have a facilities challenge in most of our school districts on the class size front. They could not accommodate class sizes of 17, even if they were given the money to do so. And so part of the challenge in the class size funding is, are we sending it out in a way that schools can actually spend it? And we had a couple of schools who had to send money back this year because either they could not accommodate all-day K or they could not accommodate the class size money that they were given. And so we have some issues to work out, to say the least, when it comes to class size funding in 2015.
This is our last question, and it's such a large question that I'm going to just shorten it, and that is, it's on the levy swap idea,
yep.
And so is some variation on the levy swap idea still alive?
Yes, and you know, it couldn't be more complicated, involving local taxes, state taxes, property taxes. You've got a great deal of variance between districts in terms of what they are currently garnering from their local tax base. And so one solution that addresses the concerns and the needs of all districts when it comes to levy reform is incredibly difficult. That said, when you look at the McCleary ruling, it's important to note that the McCleary ruling had three pillars. One was the overall amount that our state spends on education, and the court finds us to be wanting in terms of the overall amount that we spend. A second pillar was that the current structure of how we collect and spend those dollars in and of itself is unconstitutional. And so we have to address the relationship between the state and the local school districts and the way the levies relate to one another. When you look at those, and the third pillar was about outcomes, that the ruling was very clear in that it isn't just about funding formulas, but about a system that ensures that our high school graduates are ready to meaningfully contribute to our economy and democracy. And so any McCleary solution has to address all three of these elements: the total amount of money that we spend, restructuring the current relationship between the state and local school districts, and ensuring that money is spent effectively. Not an easy task. But on the levy front, when you look at the fact that we have over $5 billion in local levy capacity that could be used to address a big chunk of the state's responsibility for McCleary, in a state that has routinely in recent years rejected large statewide tax increases, we are hard-pressed to see an avenue forward on this that does not include some form of levy reform, levy swap, levy innovation, whatever you want to call it, where the state assumes an amount of local taxing authority in a revenue-neutral way to address McCleary. It's going to be hard. People have very different views about this, but I have a hard time seeing that it's not at least part of the ultimate solution to our school funding problems.
Thank you so much, Frank. I see a levy swap and funding levinars in our future.
Indeed.
So for those of you still on, don't forget, if you missed part of the presentation today or you'd like to download the slides, they're available on our website at www.educationvoters.org. And watch out for our next series of levinars that will be coming in April. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.